Okay, while everyone's grabbing their seats, just a couple of thoughts. When I was comparing to business world to church world, there's a ruthlessness in the business world that should not be present in the church world in terms of decision making and that sort of thing, hard decisions. So, got to be a little careful there. But I think churches have been poor at making hard decisions. So, we could be a bit better at that, while at the same time not being ruthless, because it is family. So that's that family thing again. And someone also drew to my attention, you can be painting a picture of leadership that sounds so beautiful and wonderful, and it's hard work. So be aware that it is hard work. It can be quite costly. And not everyone will necessarily be naturally gifted, God gifted for leadership. So I have a sense that most people can be trained to a certain level of leadership, but there are other levels of leadership where if you're not gifted in it, it just becomes a very crushing experience. So if you ever find yourself somewhere where you think it's really not working and I'm not able to lead the people who are on my team, then there's no shame in sharing that with someone. So you can either get help and training, or you work out, I'm not necessarily gifted in that, and that's okay. Because there are other ways that we can serve Christ. And yeah, it's not like leadership is the gift. That's helpful. Let me just do two things in our final time together. Let's talk about decision-making, teams and decision-making, and training others. So, and I was just thinking about your growth group leaders, your community group leaders. You might be thinking, I don't really have a team. Now, the weird thing about community group is, in one sense, the whole group is a team because you're all trying to help each other grow in Christ, in love of the word and maturity in prayer. And so you're trying to harness your whole growth group as a team. But hopefully also within that, you've got a core group, a few who are really switched on and really trying to make that happen. And that's almost like a team within a team. But then you might even have within that a small team like you and a leader in training, or you and a co-leader. You're a female assistant. So a little team within the team. So keep applying all those things to that little team. In fact, those three tiers of team within a growth group. Because I keep seeing everything in team. We are a team as a church. We're a team of teams. Everything is just teams put together into a larger team. And so it applies everywhere. Decision making. At the core of team, say we're going to move into the meetings, but particularly the decision-making part. At the core of good team meetings is decision-making. Now, it's not the only thing you do, not necessarily even the most important thing you do, but it is a very core and important thing you do. Because, as we've talked about, it fosters ownership, it brings excitement and energy to the team, it brings about better solutions than if you just came up with the solutions yourself, because there's multiple minds on the same thing, people who are engaged in the ministry on the ground level, because increasingly, sometimes you're not the one doing the ministry. So you actually need the people involved in doing the on-the-ground work to be part of it. And it builds a team to be a team. Not just doing things together for a common mission, but also deciding how best to achieve that common mission together. Very powerful factor in building a team. So how do we do it? How do we make good decisions? Now, here's a few thoughts. One, make sure key decisions are brought to the team meeting and time is made to discuss them properly. That seems fairly simple. But actually stick it on the agenda, the key decisions, and actually make a good chunk of time so that you actually can throw them around. Secondly, make sure discussion and decision-making is genuine. That means all the discussion is taken into account in making the decision. I don't know if you've ever done this, but I've come as the leader knowing the decision that I wanted to make, engineered the discussion in such a way that it came to my decision, my conclusion, and then we made that decision together. It's great. but that's not real decision making. You really want people's input. Now, that can feel very risky, but it's actually good for teamwork, a key to good teamwork. And if things feel like they're getting out of hand and they're moving in a direction that you are worried about or it looks like it's going to make a bad decision, you're the leader. You don't need to let that decision be made. And you can also say things like, I think we need time to discuss this further, or I need to think about this further, or let's take this offline till next meeting, or there's lots of ways to move things in certain directions, or we're not coming to an agreement about this. Maybe we'll take this offline for a while, and you don't come back to it for a period. But generally, what I find is it's in the process of actually making decisions, you're shaping one another to make good decisions. It's actually a discipling process in itself. You're helping people to think with good convictions and to get values in place as they make decisions. So, but that's quite a high-level skill set. So you've got to do it as you feel able to do it, but there's something very powerful in it. And as you do it, you've got to keep people on track. So allow reasonably wide-ranging discussion, because often actually what I find is you're discussing this and it sort of trickles off, and then you find you're discussing this and you need to sort of pull people back. But this thing that they've highlighted actually is a bigger thing. This is the real thing we need to be discussing. And so you pull it back and you close this one off and now let's move on to this, because it's actually in the discussion that you unearth things that you may not have otherwise unearthed, that tend to be the critical things for the functioning of teams. Because people don't want to tell you when things suck for them as a team member. But as you discuss things, things start to come out because they can't hold it in anymore. And then you actually start to see the real underbelly. And then when you see that, you're like, oh, now I really know what's going on. Now we can really have a real discussion about what's going on. And it may be that you're reshaping the role, reshaping the around what's going on, or reshaping this part of the ministry. Get good at asking questions is number four. Often we tend to speak a lot as leaders or make a lot of statements, and yet we need to get better at the other end, which is asking a lot more questions rather than making a lot of statements. Questions that clarify things, questions that challenge people, are questions that push for penetrating insight, that are trying to go beneath the surface. I've heard the triple question is quite powerful. Why is that? Yeah, why is that? Why is that? That's what kids do, isn't it? But you actually get to that's the real layer. That's the real cause. That's what's really going on there. One large concern that team leaders have is what happens if I have people on my team who are not well equipped to make good decisions, who are going to say unhelpful things, or just don't have the framework to understand ministry well and contribute good ideas. Well, it's a challenge, isn't it? It's a challenge, but it's also an opportunity, and I think I've said it, but it's an opportunity to actually train and mould and shape them to help them think about things. Now, it's not like our teams are a democracy and everyone votes and that's the decision. Like, you're the leader. And yes, we want everyone to have opportunity to speak, but we don't weight everything that is said with equal value. It's about wisdom and making a good decision. And as we do that, hopefully what will happen, and what I've seen happen over time, is team members actually start to think like the team and actually start to be able to make good decisions because they have a whole new paradigm and framework and way of thinking that's more biblical, more sensible, more wise, more has the parameters more clearly in view. Now, that whole thing can be quite an uncomfortable process. But is actually quite a powerful process and has a big impact. Second to this, I just want to highlight two really key things to pay attention to as we work on decision making as teams. And the first one is this, and this is a very powerful one. It comes from Lencioni. Is anyone reading Lencioni stuff? He's great. He does all his leadership stuff as stories. It's just fantastic to read. And one of the key things, he calls it mind for conflict. I've called it dig for disagreement. So I think that's better. Dig for disagreement. The actual making of a decision is not that difficult when all the info is out on the table. But if all the info is not out on the table, it's actually very hard to make a real decision because there's all sorts of hidden stuff. It's not shared. Often lying beneath the surface of any discussion are disagreements, unraised thoughts, tensions or conflicts. And people don't like tension. They don't like disagreement. They don't like conflict. And so they won't say these things. They won't come out. People can be sitting in a meeting, and you will know this from your workplaces, surely. People are sitting in the meeting and they're feeling uneasy about where a decision is heading, but they don't speak up. Or they may be disagreeing on the inside. No, 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 but they don't say it out loud. Or they have things that are just sort of locked inside them that need to be said so that all the info is there and we can make a good decision, but they're locked in and they're unshared and they don't come out. And so important information is buried and we make poor decisions because of it. It's important, and this is not easy again, as team leaders, to be digging in order to release those things. Now, that sounds frightening, doesn't it? Sounds like therapy. Just open it up and let us know what you really think. But it's really important for mining for conflict or for digging for disagreement or trying to raise to the surface underlying tensions. Toby, you don't seem like you're on the same wavelength. What are you thinking here? That's sort of thing. I noticed that you haven't said anything. Can you think in a ways to draw people out? Now it can feel very uncomfortable, can't it? But if it's managed well so that people treat each other with love and respect, now I've been in many meetings and they're usually not down here, honestly. They're usually up here amongst staff where there's a lot of heat. So in church? Yes. A lot of heat, conflict, disagreement, tension. And it's better that and that it come out and you discuss it and you fight in a loving, non-hostile way, you know, disagree vocally, rather than people going away actually having that stuff buried inside, deep resentments, anger, they didn't get stuff out so you couldn't make real decisions. Now, you've got to work out how you manage that. And that's particularly at the high level, those sort of things. But I just think it underlines the point. You want to try to get what's locked inside people out. How do I do that? How do I get people to speak frankly and freely? And because they don't want to tell you because you're the leader. Second to that, which is linked, is the yeah, nah syndrome, which is one of the things that often occurs is team members are sitting there and they seem to be saying, yeah, let's go with that. Yeah, that sounds good. But in their heart of hearts, they're like, nah, I'm not doing that. I'm not. Now, you've done it, haven't you? We've all done it. Sat in places where decisions are being made, but inside we were like, I'm not doing it. I don't care how good you think this idea is. There's no way that I'm doing that. They don't speak up because it's too hard. They don't like conflict. They don't think they can persuade others to their point of view. You know, some people in meetings are very verbally persuasive, very quick. You know, it's like trying to play tennis with someone who's really good. I just can't play tennis like you play tennis. You know, so they don't want to speak up. And so while they seem to be saying yes, they're actually saying no. And so we need our teams to unify behind the decisions we make and own the decisions we make and carry through the decisions we make, even if the decision was vigorously disagreed with in the context of the discussion. But once we've made the decision together, we own that decision, even if I disagreed with it when I was making my argument. Now, the team leader needs to be the person who holds people to this standard and calls out the yeah-nah syndrome, calling them to account. And part of heading off the yeah-nah syndrome is actually the digging for disagreement process. Because if you've dug for disagreement and you've drawn those things out early, then people feel that they've been heard and we can make a real decision and people can then unify around that decision, feeling like they've been heard and own it, rather than say, yeah, but they're really thinking, nah, because they had all that stuff locked in them. So key to healthy teams is good decision-making. Now, come back at me there. Any thoughts there or...? Yeah, I think it's a they're not given equal weight because people are of lesser value, or you know, I listen to that person, but I don't listen to that person. We want to give their thoughts the merit that the thoughts deserve, and I guess that's just life. We're always trying to judge and weigh and evaluate. Like we live in a world that says don't judge, by which I mean don't disagree with anyone. I just think that's not what Jesus says. He means don't be judgmental, don't be condemnatory of things. But then he says make wise judgments. And I think that's just life. We just need to be trying to make wise judgments and help our team make wise judgments. So I don't know if I can go deeper to the key behind that, but yeah, it's good. All right, let's move into training. Last section. And you've got to train your teams, but you've also got to be thinking, I've got to reproduce myself. Key to every M, key to ministry, is leadership succession and expansion. So, you know, succession, the king is dead. Long live the king. You need another king to replace the king who died. If a leader goes, you need someone else to replace them. If the growth group leader moves on, community group leader moves on, then you need another community leader or whatever that might be. Kids teacher moves, succession. But you're also thinking expansion because we want to multiply what we're doing. And the only way that we can actually reach more people is to grow and expand. And so we actually need, I don't just need to, I'm going to lose three community group leaders at the end of this year or three teachers, kids teachers at the end of the year. But I also want to add three groups at the end of this year. And so I need six. How am I going to get six more leaders for next year in the kids ministry? Well, I've got to think about training. How am I going to train? And there's probably different ways to do that. But it's crucial, however you do it. There's a famous quote, Archilochus, Greek soldier, said, "We do not rise to the level of our expectations. We fall to the level of our training." I think that's true, isn't it? Sport, school, work, whatever it is. We don't rise to the point of, I think I'm going to get to... No, we fall to how well we've been trained. And so taking on training for us, for our teams, for our potential future team leaders, succession and expansion is absolutely crucial. And actually, if we don't take responsibility for training, it can actually be unkind. To make people perform at a level beyond which they're trained to perform is not a caring thing. So one key aspect of caring for a team is training the team so that they don't feel... You haven't set them up for a failure, basically. You've set them up to win. So the first key thing for team leaders to do with regard to training is recognise it's essential and take ownership of it. And hopefully there's wider structures that will help that. Now, today is an example of that. Second thing that's key for team leaders to do with regard to training is to understand how people learn to do a role or a job. And there's probably lots of ways, but one thing that I've found particularly helpful is the 70-20-10 principle. Have people seen that one? Heard a couple of murmurs, yeah. I just think we were doing stuff like this for a long while and then we heard this and we're like, oh, that's it. That's heaps clearer than what we're trying. It's basically this. How do people learn to do their job? 10% is by coming to something like this, where there's a talking head up the front, a conference, a course, some sort of teaching, some sort of... That's 10%. 20% of how you learn to do your job is by networking, best practice, talking to other people who have the same job in your organisation or other organisation. What do you do? What do you do? Oh, that sounds better. I'm going to do that. Getting best practice from learning from others. 70% is you do it. You just give it a go. You try things. You fail. You learn other things. When that's combined with learning best practice from others and training courses, that's a very powerful package. But once you recognize that, you realize if every time we talk about training, we mean that, it's not going to be as effective as if we mean that. And so I want to design a training system that's doing the 10 and the 20 and the 70. And whenever I do the 10, I want to package it with the 20. So whenever we do, say, a growth group leaders launch or a ministry team leaders launch where we do something like this, we gather all our growth group, community group leaders together, or another time we gather all our ministry team leaders together, we'll do some upfront stuff and then we'll break them out into coach teams. We don't use the word coach, but little coach teams where the coach will have the team leaders with them, or the coach will have the community leaders with them. And then they'll unpack what we talked about and think about how you would input that, apply that into your particular ministry and your particular area, which is what you're doing after this, is that right? Something like that. Kinda. It's good. So we try to package those two together. But it also highlights that the big boy, the one that really is going to, we need to maximise, is the 70%, which is the on-the-job training. So let me focus in on that for a little bit. The 70. How are you going to do this? Well, it sort of takes starting to build a bit of a leadership pipeline. And one of the key things is that I learned very early on when trying to look after all the growth groups and stuff is you're gonna lose community group leaders regularly. And that's a very, very stressful thing if you're responsible for them, if you own it. And so how am I going to replace those? Well, I'm actually going to have to do crisis prevention. Not just do that when a crisis comes, try to scramble and find a new leader. I actually need to prevent the crisis. The only way I can do that is if I've got a pipeline of leaders running through, so that whenever, or growing up, so that whenever I need one, I can just pick one off the tree and put them in place. Now, it's never that easy. And I'll tell you, whatever scale your church, leadership is always the biggest issue, having enough leaders. But the Americans talk about it as having a deep bench, so having lots of people sitting on the subs, you know, ready to come on when someone else needs to go off. And so what we did with Growth Group is something very complex. We just put a leader in training in every group. Now, you can't put a leader in training in every group because you don't have enough people, but we got the mindset of we'd love a leader in training in every group. And so we started placing leaders in training in each of our groups. And I'd love all our ministry teams to start having that mindset as well. We're not there yet. You can't necessarily resource every group, but that's where we're trying to go. And once you have them in the group, then you need to start working out, well, how do we develop the 70? And here are a few ideas. Firstly, make sure your trainee is clear about what they're supposed to do. How do you train someone for a role? Well, you've got to make clear what they're supposed to do. It'll likely include some sort of clear, concise role description. That might feel too corporate at this stage. It might be too family. We don't want that. Sort of. But a one-pager, just with a clear role description, that can be quite a helpful, powerful tool. But the thing is, once they have that, they know their role clearly, and you can help them with that and hold them accountable to that and all the things that come with that. Secondly, and it's sort of this, you model for them how to carry out the role. So either you, but it might not be you as the team leader, you might get one of the other team members to model the role so they can learn the role, so they can see how to do it, and then they know how to do it. And they might then have a go themselves, but then see it modelled. There might be quite a long time period where it's being modelled and they're having a go and all those sort of things. And then you move through the steps. You let them do it, but you coach alongside them. Number three, give the trainee the opportunity to carry out the role for themselves. Which I guess is that. You might choose to let them start doing a portion of the role rather than the entirety of the role. You might choose to give them a shot at the whole role straight up, but that depends on the complexity of the role, the skill level of the person. And you want to do it under supervision so that you can give them close coaching and all the help that they need. And the trainee will often need to carry out the role many times before they move into a competency situation where they're pretty much doing it and you're watching, and eventually they're totally competent and you've stepped away and you're just monitoring more from a distance. Four, reflection. So get the trainee to reflect on how they think they went and how they might improve. So they know the role, they're doing the role, they've watched you do the role, they're having a go at doing the role with feedback, they've got reflection going on. They're thinking about how did I go, what went well, what went badly, which enables them to start self-correcting and improving, and creates an environment of self-starters, people who can fire themselves up and step into any role. Fifth, I probably already said this, but observe them and give them feedback, which will also help them in their self-reflection, because you'll see things they won't. Next time when they self-reflect, they'll see those things as well. Sixth, give them the opportunity to try again and again and again and again and again and again and again until they gain competence over time. And I think that's one of the key things. The 70% is just do it and keep doing it with self-evaluation and feedback. It's fairly simple, very powerful, very few people do it. Because every time we talk of training, we go and we do that. But if we've built that, these things supplement and enhance that. And then the thing you can start doing is actually building training that people can, that help them to give them, to give them feedback and self-evaluation, which is what we're trying to do. And then seven, once they are competent, give them the opportunity to train someone else. It's the medical, see one, do one, teach one. I don't know if they still say that. They do. Good. So you see one. In fact, you might need to see a few. You might need to do hundreds. But then you teach it. And once you teach it, you have full mastery. So my kids do a number of sports. One of the sports they do is karate. And they really love it. But one of the cool things is they learn stuff, self-defense and skills and stuff. And then they go up their belts. And then other ones come in with different belts, the younger ones. And then everyone teaches below. So you learn, but then you teach. You learn, but then you teach. Which gives them far greater mastery than if they just learnt. It actually, yeah, it's very clever. Very clever. So there you go. There's a basic framework of on-the-job training. 70-20-10, maximise the 70, and in the 70, keep thinking about how do we help people do that with self-reflection, feedback, and then get to the point where they can actually train others. Yeah, it's good. First thing I neglected to say, but would probably be helpful to say, is each tier is setting the boundaries in which decisions can be made, I guess. That's one of the things is, while you want people bottom up, passing things up that they think should be improved, and they need to be listened to, because we need to make sure that things are, communication's going up, so that we're making good decisions about what we do. There is also a sense in which, as the coach of multiple groups, or as the leader of a department who's watching all the coaches, meeting with coaches, team leaders, you've got a view of the entirety. So you need to be able to make boundaries. We give you decision making ability within these certain boundaries. So you set a certain framework of, we hold these values, these are the principles, we do this way, these are non-negotiables. So here's the paddock, here's the fence. Within that paddock, you run and make decisions. So you may find that goes a little way towards helping you is there's certain boundaries that have been handed down and sit around your team. And so you might have already decided about how many new songs and how many ratios and how that all functions. I don't know, but you can set up a system that has the boundaries, and then within those, people can run and play. So that's one thing. But apart from that, I don't know. part of it is trying to help people recognise when things are preference and when things are philosophical or biblical. So people have a really hard time working that out. Even see it in terms of church size. So large churches will be tempted to say that large church is the biblical model. Small churches will be tempted to say that small church is the biblical model. Whereas I just don't think the Bible says how you should structure your church, or whether large is better or whether small. Both have pros and cons, and really we just need to reach heaps more people. Yeah. Anyway, people will assign a biblical or philosophical value to something that is purely a personal preference or their experience to something they've experienced in their past. So part of us helping people make good decisions, or teams make good decisions, is helping people see, which isn't always easy, helping people see when the things that they hold dearly are actually just individual preference things. That's not easy, but that's part of it. But that actually creates a far more mature and robust Christian, because it helps all of us let go of things that have been so sacred to us. When you realise the reason I hold that as sacred is because I grew up in that youth ministry and that's what they did. It's like parenting. You tend to parent the way you were parented, or in opposition to the way that you were parented, or usually a bit of a combination of both. It's hard to take on a totally new framework and parent in a different way. Now, it is possible, but you often have values attached to certain... I don't know if the illustration's working, but yeah. But once you can get outside your personal preferences and realise what are biblical constraints and what values actually impact the whole church, they're not biblical, but they have an impact, then you can make more objective, wise decisions rather than just emotional-based decisions. And that counts for us as well. Oh, no, I regularly want to give up. Spurgeon called the ministry a killing work. That's what Spurgeon called it. And we've all got difficult jobs. Like, I think life's hard and leadership is hard. I think it's just the truths of the gospel and trying to make sure that I keep being rooted in those and not trusting myself. So trying to keep myself in places where, you know, in context where I'm sitting under the word, where I'm engaging with the word with others, where we're praying together, where just the disciplines of the Christian life, really. But particularly in a way where I'm a bit distrustful of myself as a sinful human being. So doing everything I can to weight my life to help me make good decisions and sit in the context of the gospel. And now that's one of the benefits of leadership in church life. One of the great wonderful benefits in leadership in church life is it makes you be in the context that actually most rich and helpful for you. Yeah, there can be lots of negative things, but it keeps pushing you to be close to the word and close to God's people and prayerful. And so there's a real, real benefit to you and to your family. Like, it's a great blessing to have my family see, like, they'll see the negative things of church, you know, because they'll feel it the most, because it's hard to hide anything as much as you try from your kids. But you know what I hope? I hope they also see the wonderful blessings it is to be part of church, and also that it was worth sacrificing whatever for the gospel. Yeah. So I'm trying to live this tension with my kids of, I never wanted them to feel like the church nicked my dad. And he was never around and he didn't have enough time for us and he didn't really care. I don't want them. But I also don't want them to, I also want for them to feel like, but yeah, we made sacrifices and he wasn't around as much as he could be. And it did cost us as a family, but that's good. Because there's something bigger than us. So I'm trying to, don't know if I'm doing it well, but I'm trying to live in that tension with my family. And I think one of the blessings of leadership in the church is it keeps pulling you into that environment rather than... That's a good question. And we struggle, I don't think it's necessarily just a church scale thing either. Like, I think we struggle with that too. Because every, you know, you go to our night congregation, which is mainly young adults, and yes, youth is the killer. Like, that's what everyone wants to be. Some churches you'll go to and being up front on the stage, being in the band, and that's the one. Like, it just depends on where you go, the lawyers. And ones that'll often be hard is kids, creche. Is that hard for you guys? I think that's often a hard one. Like, looking after other people's kids, after I've looked after my own, that's not that appealing to lots of people. Sorry, that might say something about me rather than about that. So I think it is a challenge. Different spheres of church will have different competitive advantages, I think. So we've got to try to work out what those are and try to help those come forward. So that's part of it. So as we're recruiting people into different areas, what we've found is we've tried to do a few things. And I'm not sure that these are the best things, but here's a few ideas. One is the ministry M arbitrates. So the ministry M actually helps recruiting, helps volunteers come into all the ministries. And when there's a, I want them as a kids ministry leader, I want them in the band, the ministry M, knowing the needs of the whole, makes the final decision, not the different ministries. So it tries to give some fairness and weighting towards ministries that constantly lose out. Because others seem more sexy, so it's, we've set up a modified market place. It's not totally free, and I'm not sure about the wisdom of that. American churches don't do that, but we've tried to do that. I think because American churches are growing so quickly, there's always a stream of volunteers to come in. It's a very different culture, very Christianized culture in most places. So that's one thing we try to do. Celebration is another really important one. You try to work out the areas in church life which are really struggling or finding it hard to recruit people in, and you give them platform time in church regularly and really celebrate those ministries and everything that's going good there. And so you try to profile them really extensively, because that again can sort of push people in that direction. But then there's the competitive advantage thing. Membership meets every new person that comes into church. Maturity, every person sits in a community group in church. MAG, you see it up the front each week. Mission is something we bang on it. So you're trying to work out, kids meet all the parents of the, so you're trying to work out how do you maximize what each M does to try to make much of it in people's minds to draw those people in. But that's, for me, is one of the hardest things to work out in church, is we don't want to nick each other's people, but there's only so many people. How do we design a system where all the M's are firing really well, where not some ministries get left out because they're harder? Yeah, it's almost the body thing as well, isn't it? Like, some bits of the body don't seem as important, but they're really important, and you don't see them because they've got a shoe over them and they're down there. Like, we've got to, no, look, here's the foot. Like, lift it up. So I don't know if that helps. That's just that is a challenge, yeah.
Can I have one thing there, which is, I think teams are key there. I think youth ministry is sexy because usually it functions as a team of leaders. Like, you meet often, you're always celebrating the wins, you're always solving problems together. And I think the reason youth is always a great thing to be part of is because it really does function as a team. I think the other ministries of the church tend not to function as teams, they function as rosters, and no wonder no one's excited about them. And I think the churches where it's fun to be on the stage and the band is because the band's functioning as a team. And I think, well, what if all the other ministries could function as a team? It'd actually be really fun. And I think our parish council, which is, I think it's a fun team to be a part of.
And it's sexy.
the wardens who meet with a bit more, just a lot more administrative. I think I still, maybe would you say that's a fun thing? Because there's a sense of team there. Task is, it's just a, you know, it's a silly, boring, not silly, it's a boring task. But, a team is so important.
Yeah.
And I don't think we're nailing that as a church. Hence, you know, three folks there is leadership, but we're not going to have good teams unless leaders are leading the teams. Teams, and then individuals, not every individual in a team, and knowing the next step in that out.
What's the ratio of people serving in a church?
It's actually,
generally it's like 8 to 20%
of people doing 8% of the work, yeah. But actually, I think the number of people, lots of people are serving, but they're not fully engaged. And why is that? I think it's not because they're not interested, it's because we haven't shown them how and set them in well enough, that our onboarding hasn't been clear and helpful enough to show them here's what to do. And as I look around, you know, I think we've got a real lack of these and these. I think our church is filled with the most talented people I've ever met at any church. Like, you look around and you're all really effective in your careers. Why don't we have enough coaches and team leaders? It's not because we don't have the quality, it's because we've done nothing with the quality that are here. And so, therefore, how do I get you fully engaged in greater leadership levels? I think we really failed as staff to onboard you well, provide these boundaries. This is your area of responsibility. Here's how you do it. Go for it. Here's, as a leader, what you've got to do. Gather your team regularly.
Okay.